Good afternoon. Hi, Mr. Gustine. House Judiciary Committee is in at 1:05, in attendance, Representative Holmes, myself, Representative Brambers, Representative Coghill, Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, my lunch date, and Representative Dahlstrom is excused, and I assume that we will see Representative Samuels along shortly. We're going to begin with a presentation from Mr. Gottstein on psych rights, the law project for psychiatric rights.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gruenberg?
Can I ask a question? It's a scheduling question.
Yes, sir.
I think we have a new CS on House Bill 7, and I think the problems have been cured, and if you wanted to take that up first, we could pass it out very quickly, and then Representative Lynn, patience would have been rewarded.
No, let's, with the chairman, let's continue on your schedule.
Okay.
And I have great faith in chair that we'll get the other one on time.
I just don't want to leave this bill hanging again.
Or this gentleman here.
Well, I don't mind waiting, but I mean, so whatever.
It's a painful. It's a painful process to watch. So with that, Rep. Samuels is here. Nice to see you. And you may begin. We're happy to have you here, sir.
Well, thank you, Chairman Ramirez. I appreciate your giving me time. I was down here on other business, and it seemed like it made sense for me to give a report on these two cases, just to bring the committee up to speed on them. Before I begin talking about those, I really want to put the situation in a little bit of a larger perspective, which is, it's pretty clear that the way that our mental health system is set up is doubling the number of people who never recover after being diagnosed with serious mental illness. And I can go into that, and I cited some papers in the email, I think you've got them, that I wrote, that kind of goes into that. But that's kind of the I think the broader perspective on all of this, and of course there are a lot of consequences to that. There's terrible consequences to the people involved, that they end up with what could have been and could be a temporary disruption in their life, that they then get put on this permanent track as a mental patient and get put on, and this is really the governmental interest, Social Security disability income. They pretty much all get, virtually all of them get put on that track, and then Medicaid and stuff, and they end up being a permanent burden on the government treasury, and that doesn't really have to be. And the involuntary commitment and forced drugging system that we have plays a significant role in that, and that's the, especially the forced drugging part of it, is the mission of the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, which is to fight unwarranted court-ordered psychiatric drugging, which I call forced drugging. And the first two cases that we brought that have had recent Alaska Supreme Court decisions, one in June and one just last month, both of which held certain portions of the Alaska statutes to be unconstitutional, and that's kind of that's what I wanted to talk about today. One held, well, first, under AS 4730-839, basically what the statute says, if someone is found to be incompetent to make a decision about whether they should take the drugs or not, the hospital gets to do whatever they want. I won't get into right now kind of the pretty dubious nature of these competency determinations. I might later, because it really gets to this issue of the public defender agency basically presenting any real defenses for people. So it ends up being really phony representation, and it's led to the situation where the involuntary system is essentially operating way outside the bounds of constitutionality. So
before you begin, I was remiss. would you introduce yourself and who you're here representing? Because I see Psych Rights Law Project for Psychiatric Rights. I don't know anything about that entity.
Right. Yeah, I'm Jim Gottstein, president and CEO of the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, also known as Psych Rights. And its mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock around the country. And we've been doing that since late 2002. And, of course, I'm located here, and we've been doing quite a bit of work here, and we also do it around the country. There's no forced electroshock in Alaska, so that's not really an issue here, but it is in other places.
I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Absolutely. Well, it turns out, actually, that these psychiatric drugs, when they first came on the market, they were heralded as being miracle drugs because they had the same effect as a lobotomy, and that's what they do. One of the things they do is block 70 to 90% of the dopamine transmission in the frontal lobes, and so they are actually chemical lobotomies, and they have some other effects as well. And so when you get to these legal determinations about whether or not the court should force someone to take these drugs, what the statute said was if the person is found to be incompetent to decide, the hospital gets to do whatever they want. And what that does is assume that whatever the hospital psychiatrists want is the right thing for the person. And the court held very clearly that that is not the case, that whether or not someone is to be forcibly drugged is a legal question, and it's whether or not it's in their best interest is a legal question that a court has to decide by clear and convincing evidence. And that was the first core holding in the Myers case, is that the court has to decide that. The second thing is that that's a constitutional principle. The other constitutional principle is that the right to keep to make decisions about what goes into your body, especially mind-altering drugs like this, is a fundamental right. And before the government can come in and deprive someone of that right, they not only have to show it's in a person's best interest, but that there are no less restrictive alternatives available. Now, they'd say available in a couple places, and they don't say available in a couple other places in the opinion. And I put a footnote in here what that means. But I think basically that the state choosing not to make a less restrictive alternative available does not allow it to forcibly drug someone. So in other words, if the state could make a less restrictive alternative available, the state cannot force drug someone. Now, I think that there are limitations on that in terms of reasonableness and expense and all that kind of thing, but I think that's pretty clear in my mind. So those are the two core holdings in Myers. One of the things that concerns me is it appears to me that API is the Alaska Psychiatric Institute is somehow getting around that decision. It's really not following it, and we've kind of in a proceeding right now to try and figure out how it's really, in essence, defying the court's decision on that. And if I can do a little bit of an aside on that, I think one of the real problems is the lack of alternatives. Is when the state really doesn't have anything else to do, then what they'll do is they'll come in and basically, you know, lie to the court and all those kind of things to say that they meet conditions that they don't, because they don't really have any alternatives. Okay, so that's that part. In Weatherhorn, which just came down last, are there any questions about this?
So, just trying to understand this last little bit here. So, are you saying that they're getting around the court's decision because there really aren't other alternatives available and things need to be done to make other alternatives, so it's, in other words, sort of a legitimate argument? We really don't have any other ways to handle this right now. Or are you saying that they're pretending there aren't other ways available when there really are?
Well, I think it's not so much the alternatives, but it's not clear what's going on. At one point, I thought was what was happening, instead of API is citing to a very dramatic drop in the number of proceedings under this statute, but there's no less drugging going on. And so the question is, well, how, if they were doing, let's say, 500 of them 2 years ago, and they're only doing 50 of them now, and there's still the same amount of drugging going on, what's going on? And so I haven't really found out what that is. But the lack of alternatives is kind of a different issue, I think. Okay. So in Weatherhorn, there's what for invo-
oh God.
In Weatherhorn, the under the involuntary commitment statutes, people can be committed if they're a danger to themselves or others, or gravely disabled. That's what the statute says, and there's a definition of gravely disabled in AS 4739, 15.7, and there's two parts of it, an A part and a B part, and the A part says you're gravely disabled if you're not treated, serious injury or death is highly probable. Okay, well, I buy that. I think that's fine. But the B prong says that you can be locked up for being mentally ill if you're not locked up, your previous ability to function independently will deteriorate. It's like, well, that's, you know, that can be anybody. And what we said in Weatherhorn is that under the Constitution, you can't really lock someone up for being mentally ill unless you can show what we actually said. One of the things we said is you can't survive safely in freedom, which is pretty much like the A prong, and the Supreme Court agreed with us, saying that you can't lock someone up for being gravely disabled unless they can't survive safely in freedom. So that's what they decided, and it basically held unconstitutional the B prong. Now, one of the things that maybe I don't need to go through all of this. I don't know how much time you really want to hear from me. But I'm certainly available to answer questions. And kind of the couple of key things. One is, I think when I look at this situation, this whole situation in terms of people's rights being violated as a matter of course, they're being violated as a matter of course, is that the place where it's broken, is that the public defender agency does not really defend people. I mean, they're really phony. And then I thought also that I would let the committee know kind of where psych rights is heading. I think that we would much prefer to be, working cooperatively on solving some of these problems, or all of them really, than litigating. So there are some pretty important issues. This issue of representation is important. The issue of the lack of constitutionally required alternatives is important. One of the things that's going on, I think, that is just an absolute tragedy that's being hidden is, and nobody really knows the scope of the problem, is the extent to which the children that the state takes into state custody are being drugged with lots of times with drugs that haven't been approved for children, and they're very dangerous drugs. And what happens is kids get taken away from their families. They may be in terrible situations, but they act out. I mean, you know, they don't like it and stuff, and so they get taken away, and they might get sent out of state, and they act out. They act up, and what happens is they're being given these drugs.
Mr. Gostin, Representative Coghill, what's our friend's name up in Fairbanks? Frank Turney. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask on behalf of Frank Turney, the attorney, a local community activist in Fairbanks, who always is preaching about psychotropic drugs to kids in the classrooms that are being given to them involuntarily, and the other side of that, of course, are educators to say, if we don't drug these children, we won't be able to teach the other 25 kids in the classroom. But can you comment on the dispensation of psychotropic drugs in our K through 12?
On that point, are you talking about drugs like Ritalin?
That's the primary type class of drugs that's given to school kids. It's not necessarily what's happening to the kids that are being taken into custody. They're given much stronger drugs. I think that what is happening, if you look at it broadly, is that the kids are being blamed for the failures of the educational system and the failures of the adults in their lives. So there's really no evidence of any kind of brain abnormality or any kind of disease or anything in these kids that get diagnosed with ADHD. I don't know if you've seen the definition of ADHD, but it's got things like, you know, doesn't pay attention, doesn't like to sit still at a desk for hours at a time listening to a boring teacher, fidgeting, those kind of things. It literally says that. So I think that class sizes are really a pretty important feature of that. But I think it's absolutely unacceptable to say that it's okay to blame the kid, label them for life, give them these very dangerous drugs so that it's going to make it easier for the teachers and make it easier, you know, and not be so disruptive to other kids.
Representative Caulfield.
Thank you. And I appreciate you bringing Mr. Rothstein before the committee. I've long struggled with a whole range of psych evaluations from school to those in state custody to those in jail. So I think the psych evaluation process also is an issue. But I need to kind of clarify maybe three things that I would be looking for further backup. And maybe it's all in here and you can explain it. But for example, you've told us that API is lying, and is that with some of the court case backup that you have brought with some of these court case backup? Let me just do all three of them, and then you can kind of respond. The other one is the public defender. Is that a resource issue, or is that a competency issue? And certainly the alternatives is both a state and a societal issue. And then I'm interested to hear more about what you know about state custody, of children in state custody being drugged. Of all the time that I've worked in child custody issues, this is the first I've heard that accusation. And I've been digging in for a lot of years. So if I've heard it, it went right over my head. But this is the first time it's been so emphatic.
Thank you, Representative Coghill. There's actually a quote probably in each of those papers there from Professor Perlin about the endemic nature of untrue testimony by psychiatrists. I mean, basically, if this legal standard is someone has to be a danger to self or others, they will come in and recite those words, whether or not there's anything behind it to back it up. And the same with competence. And that's just kind of the way that it is. And the reason why they get away with that, to kind of segue into your next question, is that they never get challenged by the public defender agency. I mean, the Weatherhorn case, we have it on our website, the transcript, all of the papers in that case, and the transcript is on there, and you will see that the public defender, the assistant public defender, did not do a single thing on behalf of her client. And so, therefore, that is the typical case. They have between 5 and 10 hearings on Tuesdays and Fridays between 1:30 and 4:30, and this is at API. They all get involuntarily committed. I mean, I don't know if it's 98 or 99% of the time, and if there's a forced drugging petition, they all get forcibly drugged. And you know, and they do it in 3 hours, and they might, and they have 5 to 10 cases, and there it's just an assembly line process that does not resemble a true legal proceeding. In terms of the, is it a resource issue? I think it's partly that. Is it a competency issue? I think it's partly that. But I think more than that is it is it's an attitude problem, which, and the attitude basically is that if my client wasn't crazy, she'd know what this was. This is good for her. And that's not the role of the attorney that's supposed to be representing that client. And it's also, it turns out, not to be true. And that's why I started out by talking about the broader issue, which is that this system is turning people into permanent mental patients and permanent wards on the state. So anyway, that's kind of the answer to that. So,
and on the state custody issue, so I'll
can I?
It just seems though when you talk about API. You may think that that's misrepresentation. They may just think of it as operating within the bounds of the law. So that's kind of what I heard between us here. I'm asking you, where are they lying? You said, well, they had a legal standard, but that could be anything. So I don't know that I'm ready to sit down and say that they're actually out lying. We might not have given them a good enough standard to deal with. So I'm just in that dialogue, I'm trying to discern here. There's many things I tend to agree with you on, but I need to make sure that that I don't just take a gratuitous statement without some discovery. You know.
Yeah. No, I understand that. And in the paper, I think both papers, that the one that, about the whole country, the larger one, the one about Alaska, I quote Professor Perlin, where he describes this. What he talks about is that the psychiatrists will say whatever is they're supposed to say in order to achieve what's considered, you know, the societal good. So, I mean, basically.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not without some experience in this, and a friend of mine had a toolbox fall on his head and in an airplane and went temporarily berserk. He just lost it. And rather than dealing with the injury, they did put him into a psychiatric center. And rather than dealing with his injury, they did drug him, and involuntarily, with no hope of him ever being able to defend himself. So I can assure you that I know what it looks like from at least a friend's eyes to be put in a situation where you not only don't get the help you want, but you're a prisoner.
Right, and I think it's perfectly legitimate to challenge my assertion about that. And, you know, but that's my perception of it. I think it's accurate, and I think it's certainly legitimate for you to challenge that.
And what about state custody children, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I've been trying. I mean, I can't say that I spent a huge effort on it, but for 2 or 3 years, I've been trying to get the state to actually go and look at the records of the kids in state custody, especially out of state, and find out what drugs are being given and all that. And they haven't done it. I don't think they're really, really compiling those records. But what we know from other states is that about 70% of the kids in state custody are receiving psychiatric drugs.
Chairman, I'm going to interrupt because I want others to speak. But I'm just going to say, Mr. Godstein, at this point it's a suspicion that you have. And I think it was an assertion that was much stronger than a suspicion when I first heard it. So I'm open to discussion, but I just wanted to let you know that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah. And I think it's more, I think that's a fair comment, but I'd also like to say that especially with the kids that are being sent out of state to residential treatment centers, that's what they do. They lock them up and they drug them. That's their programs. So I think it's more than speculation.
The other side of that, though, and then we'll go to Representative Lynn, that we heard yesterday from the Department of Corrections, are prisoners that like to fake mental issues in order to. It was one of the things I remember the Commissioner of Corrections talked about yesterday, where prisoners that try to come into incarceration with the pretense of having a disease or an illness to get treated for it. Of leniency to their sentence, so it's, and they talk specifically about API's numbers declining and it becoming the burden of the correction center to care for mental patients and those individuals with mental problems.
Well, there's no question that that corrections is the largest inpatient psychiatric facility in the state. There's no question about that.
Just with regard to that, Mr. Chairman, sure. Maybe I could inquire, since that you have taken legal action in many cases. I see two huge cases here. So then, has there been a challenge to evaluation processes by the Department of Correction at all?
I had a case a couple years ago. It's on our website, too, the Bavila case. And they have a forced drugging procedure in prison that's modeled after a U.S. Supreme Court case called Washington versus Harper. And Ms. Bavila didn't want to be forcibly drugged, and I took her case and stuff. And basically, we got the state to admit that they were violating Washington versus Harper, but I had made a rookie legal mistake. I don't know if it was a rookie mistake or not, but they got the case dismissed on the grounds that you can't sue the king on sovereign immunity grounds. I sued the Department of Corrections instead of the commissioner, and that's not really clear that you have to sue the commissioner instead of the state in Alaska. But anyway, that case got dismissed, and my client was not being forcibly drugged at that time and didn't want to pursue it. So, but it's sitting out there, and it's very clear to me that the procedures that the Department of Corrections uses does not follow the United States Supreme Court guidelines. And in prison, prisoners have the fewest due process rights of anybody. So, but they have some. For example, they have the right to cross-examine witnesses. They have the right to call their own witnesses. And the Department in this proceeding, they wouldn't let her cross-examine. We had a psychiatrist that we were prepared to bring, and they said, and it's also supposed to be an adversary process. Oh, this isn't an adversary process. We have our own psychiatrist. We don't need yours. And they wouldn't. They said she couldn't have an attorney, and that she had to put her questions in writing ahead of time. And so it's very clear that process is unconstitutional. But I haven't, really had a chance to get back to it yet. And that's different than people that want the drugs. I mean, I really want to make that clear, is that I know people that find the drugs helpful, and I think that they should have access to them. But for the people that don't want them, they shouldn't be forced to take it, and certainly not without compliance with the statutory and constitutional requirements for doing so. And that's kind of the message that I have.
I think we'll go to about 10 till with this presentation, Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Very interesting. Maybe some of those folks who want the drugs also should not have the drugs. Representative Cargo touched on some of the areas of concern I had, because you had down here on this briefing point sheet, you said, and I quote, API flouting of Myers, you stated that as a fact, rather than that's an opinion, or is that a fact?
I think it's an informed opinion.
And
I think that it will be established as fact.
And the same thing with the illegal use of ex parte proceedings, that's an opinion or a fact?
Well, I think it's an informed opinion. I mean, I was asked, by, I think, Jane, well, what kind of statutory changes might be in order, and of course this committee would view that. And my view is most of the problems aren't statutory, but one is this issue of ex parte. And you know what ex parte is where someone goes to the judge and gets an order without the other side having a chance. And the hallmarks of due process is notice that you're being, charged with something, or someone wants to do something, and an opportunity to respond. And ex parte is completely against that fundamental due process principle. Now, there are times when that's permissible, and the one that I think is easiest to understand is in the search warrant situation, where you say, you tell the person, I'm going to go and get a search warrant to, search your car, and whatever's in there is going to disappear from the car before the hearing, right? So that is a reasonable basis for having ex parte communication, but the judge is supposed to critically look at that. Well, there might be a similar situation, and the statute contemplates that for people that they want to have involuntarily committed. But it's grossly abused. It's done all the time without the criteria for such an application, being which is there's not time. Well, actually, that's a police officer application. There's not time to bring the courts in. They don't. There's no determination that there's a reason for doing that. It's just they do it uniformly. Now, there's another part of the statute where even after someone's brought in for evaluation, they're in the hospital or they're in a designated treatment center, evaluation and treatment center, then that the hospital or the treatment center can move for an ex parte order. Well, there's no reason at that point in time, because there's no danger, the person is already in custody, why they shouldn't have an opportunity to respond.
I just want to say that, among other things, I do have a special education credential, and I've taught SED, severely emotionally disturbed teenagers, and et cetera, as a school teacher. I know that part of the problems we have in school is we have this thing called inclusion and mainstreaming and so on. So we get these kids who maybe should not be part of the regular class, but because of federal mandates and so on, they have to be in what is the least restrictive environment and so on. And so this kind of sets the stage for the kids trying to be controlled with sometimes improper use of drugs like Ritalin and so on for behavior control. And it's always the argument how much of it is because of some variety or degree of mental illness, how much of it is just a behavioral disorder, just a spoiled kid who doesn't want to work. And you don't really know, and I think you can't draw a line on it. And then, again, you know, we have this terrible problem of people that are now labeled as homeless. And that population, it seems to me, we have out and out, you know, alcoholics who are alcoholic out of their mind, and we've got drug people. But it also, and we have two homeless people who don't have the money to make their house payment. But some of these people are mentally ill people who previously were kept in mental institutions, and now they're not kept in mental institutions, so they're out on the corner doing as best they can, and some of them freezing to death. And, you know, it's a big problem that you bring up here. And then, I guess, just the last question, where do you get your funding for psychoids?
It's, I donate all my time pro bono. So that's the bulk of...
Well, basically, you're self-funding, as I understand.
No, we get most of it's private donations. Getting between $20,000 and $30,000 a year in private donations.
501c3
group? Yes, and out of the Myers case, we got an $80,000 fee award. So so part of it is...
And what did you do with the $80,000? Put it back into the program?
It hasn't been appropriated yet, but I expect... it'll go back to psych rights, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Just one last
question. Representative Kaka?
The two statutes, 4730, 915, and 839, are suggested places where something has to change. Have you proposed any suggested language? Has anybody that you know of proposed any suggested language?
No. I mean, I think basically the Supreme Court has interpreted B to require someone be, not, you know, 915.7B to be, that the person has to be unable to survive safely in freedom. So that's now the interpretation. I think that maybe that it should be amended to include that, and I think the same principle should apply to 839, that the requirements of the court be incorporated into the statute, for one thing, so people aren't confused about it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm appreciative of your eyes and ears, and it brings up an issue that I've been somewhat interested in. Have you been before the Mental Health Board?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the reception like?
Well, I think that they've been, you know, I was on the Mental Health Board for years, for a few years. The Weatherhorn just came out, so I didn't present to them this week about it. The membership has changed. I mean, basically, they've been supportive of this. It's not really their issue so much. I mean, they're really concerned with you know, funding and the mental health program and all that sort of stuff, and they haven't.
With all due respect, they're also very interested in the integrity of their delivery systems. And so I would think that if you're calling API a bad actor and lying, that would be something they'd be very interested in.
Yeah, and I think I think also, I mean, I see the real, you know, the real problem actually is with the failure of representation, because that's what's allowed the system to progress to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the.
Are there any questions for Mr. Gustin? Appreciate you rounding out Universe Force with these concerns.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you here. Thank you, Mr. Gustin. Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chairman.
Shall we try to take Hill 7?
Go, Hill 7. We're on the way here. Hope springs eternal.
It's February, Representative Lynn.
This is my birthday month, too, so I hope for a birthday present from this committee.
I'd like to hold the bill.
You want to so fast, Mr. Mack.
Dirk, can I have Jane join you? She's been working with your office, and have the two of you work on explaining the changes that we've made so far, and catch me up on it, because I was not
here.
Do we
want a motion in front of us?
Do we require one? I was not here on Monday, so I don't know
where. Adopt the new CS.
That's an M version?
The M version is new, right?
Yeah, it's version new. Okay. I have the A version. Bad chair.
While you were gone.
Lots of fun.
That's right. I was worried today, actually, Mr. Chairman. I was held my fingers through that whole thing.
Yep. Went through the succession of chairman, did we not?
All right. May I have a motion to have the CS for HB 7 in front of us, please.
Mr. Vice Chairman, the majority leader and I are arguing over who should get it, because when he had the gavel last, he threw it like a hot potato when I showed up. So,
he did, yeah.
Speaker, I'll move that we adopt the Mr. Chairman. You could do that too. That we take up for the CS for House Bill 7 Judiciary, the Bannister version labeled M.
I don't object on my own bill for a discussion. Get it out of the way.
This committee was out of control.
Yes. Sorry, I missed it. So was I, touring southeastern Alaska. So, yeah. All right, with that, Jane, Dirk?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, aide to House Judiciary Committee. And I'll explain the changes that were made to version M from version C. On page 1, lines 4 through 5, the following language was deleted. A person may not insert false information into a caller identification system with the intent to defraud. The new language reads, a person may not make a call and insert false information into a caller identification system with the intent to defraud. The change should satisfy both the committee's amendment to insert or transmit and legal's recommendation that this would better make the bill track. On page 1, lines 10 through 11, the committee requested language that helped define the crime. Legislative legal came up with the following language to fit the intent of the committee. Subsection C, a person who violates subsection A of this section by inserting, whether by making one call or more than one call, false information into four caller identification systems is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. 2, five or more caller identification systems is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. And additionally, there was a definition added for call. And call means a call made by telephone, computer, or similar communication device or technology, whether transmitted by wire or wireless means.
What a calm. Representative Samuels.
Away.
Yeah, where are you going?
On the changes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the changes, the number one where it says four caller identification systems. One call or more than one call. Less than five.
Representative Samuels through the chair. I just had a discussion with Annie Carpinetti out in the hall, and she thinks that this language should go back to less than five.
On page one, line 13, if we adopt the CS, it should read, instead of four, it should say less than five, and the other one is five or more.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'll let that go. I'll let it go.
You should hold this bill over.
Dirk?
You're the only one not smiling at the table.
Do you have anything to add?
The chair, Representative Ramirez, I'm smiling on the inside.
All right. All right. Help me out here, Representative Lynn. You objected to adopting the...
I'll move my objection.
So the CS for House Bill 7 has been adopted. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I would move amendment number...
Number one
to the CS. Move amendment number one, that on page one, line 13, you delete the word four and you insert the words fewer than five.
Thank you. Do you have that, Susan?
Yes, sir.
Right.
Less than five, excuse me. The words less than five.
Fewer.
My legal counsel in the back.
Do you have that, Susan? Is there an objection to the amendment? Seeing none, Amendment 1 passes. Are there any other amendments?
Could I get somebody to help me with the legal memorandum that came from Teresa Bannister talking about the due process issue of the two different charges? Was that taken care of in this language, yes or no? Or do we still have the due process issue that she brought up?
We should ask Anna Carbonetti, I think.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, there was some disagreement between legal and Annie Carbonetti about this, and I'll let her explain.
Good to have that on the record then, Mr. Chairman, because somewhere along the line, this may be useful information.
My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As I understand Ms. Bannister's memo, she's concerned that if you insert into five caller ID systems, a prosecutor could charge as an A or B misdemeanor. And that would be a problem if that's what the bill said, but I don't think it does the way it's been drafted. It's less than five caller ID systems, it's a B misdemeanor, and five or more is an A misdemeanor. So I don't share her concern the way it's drafted now.
So for you, Annie, the due process issue is satisfied?
I think so, yes.
Representative Greenberg.
Well, I would say that you could charge a B misdemeanor because if you make five, you also make four.
Through the chair, you know, that sort of distinction we have in all of our criminal statutes, for example.
That's why I think she's wrong.
Yeah, that's why, exactly. You know, theft of $50 or more is an A misdemeanor. Theft of less than $50 is a B misdemeanor.
I think you always retain, through the chair, you always retain that discretion. Yeah, I mean, like, you could always charge negligent driving, even though it's reckless. You have a lot of discretion.
That's correct.
So, I mean, this is something, Mr. Chair, that comes up quite often in at least my arcane discussions with legal counsel. And now you know why I'm on the phone a lot. But I think that you have the discretion, and unless somebody can show me some case somewhere that says it's unconstitutional. I would say that it's not. Are you aware of any case that is on point to support what she has said, the conclusion she's come to?
Not under these circumstances. There are, I think, decisions that say that if there are two different statutes of different levels and the act that the defendant has committed is reasonable, could reasonably charge under one or the other, that is a problem, a constitutional problem, and you have to charge under the less serious offense. But in terms of drafting this statute, I personally am not aware of any case that would say that that would be.
The greater always includes the lesser as a matter of logic, does it not?
Yes. Yes. Yes, Representative Grunberg. For God's sakes, yes.
So, I mean, that would mean everything's unconstitutional. It's left. You always have to charge under the Class B misdemeanor. I love it.
Representative Coghill.
I did not intend to take Ms. Bannister to any task necessarily, but just to clarify.
Why not?
You're getting pretty harsh over there, Mr. Grunberg. It's probably a legitimate discussion, and I just wanted to make sure that we had it clear as we were heading out of the committee with this thing that it was the two tiers, and you could always charge at the lesser. And so,
prosecutors have a wide discretion to charge and to resolve cases at a lower level than might possibly be charged or resolved, and I think that would be the case here.
Common sense clause.
Just wanted to bring it up. Didn't necessarily want to whip anybody.
Passed Amendment 1. Is there any more discussion on House Bill 7?
I'm glad we have that on the record. That's important stuff.
Great.
So what is the next committee referral, Mr. Chairman?
Nothing.
There's no other committee referral. Has to go to the Rules Committee?
Not my problem, Mr. Rules Chairman. With that, I'd be happy if somebody wanted to.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill 7 /M as amended from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Without objection, House Bill 7 moves from Judiciary.
I lived long enough.
So do we, Bob.
Pain is over,
I had a real moment.
Simple bill.
Yeah.
There are no simple bills.
And then also ignition interlocks. Is that correct, Representative Myers' bill? And then in the offing is our ethics legislation, which is. Beginning its path through State Affairs.
Our subcommittee chair in State Affairs is going to explain it, but we're having a hearing, subcommittee hearing on Saturday. They'll be working, trying to lump all this stuff into one CS, and then we'll be having a hearing on Tuesday, probably, to go camera proposed sexual analysis of the proposed sections, and then Thursday we'll go to the mat on some of these things. That's our present schedule.
Excellent.
And then it'll be handed off to the Judiciary Committee for you to pass out in just one day.
Representative Grunberg, as we adjourn, that will be your challenge.